This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. Today is with, it's going to be my first interview with a series of documentary filmmakers from Hot Docs this year, which I'm very excited about. I visited with on the phone Alethea Arnicook-Boril, her new movie Angry Inuk, which you need to see. You absolutely need to see. It premieres, world premiere May the 2nd, but it's going to be playing at Hot Docs for the next, I think there's a couple other viewings coming up. Alethea is wonderful. You're going to love this film. It's a balanced film. It's a engaging film. It's fascinating for a whole lot of reasons, but I think one of the things that really bubbles to the surface for me here is that this is a film about listening. This is a film about getting the story right, you know, and about misunderstanding. We talk about a whole lot of things. We talk about one of the things I love the most is about, we talk about humor to diffuse tension, and we talk a little bit about the Inuit sort of traditional approach to anger and to conflict, which becomes kind of a central theme, really. And Alethea talks a lot about her culture and about where she's come from and why these things are so important to her. So please, stay tuned. You're going to love this interview. You're going to fall in love with Alethea. Make sure you get out to see the film Angry Inuk, and davidpecklive.com for more podcasts and more interviews. You can get my new book, Real Change is Incremental. Stay tuned for a really interesting interview with Alethea Arnicook-Boril and Angry Inuk. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest here this morning, a filmmaker sort of celebrating, I guess, the start of Hot Docs over the weekend. Alethea Arnicook-Boril is here to talk about her new film, Angry Inuk. And Alethea, thank you so much for taking the time this morning to chat with us.
Yeah, hi David, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so I've seen the film recently, and I think it's now been shown at least two times at Hot Docs. And can you talk a little bit about the reception so far?
Well, actually, I haven't screened it yet.
Oh, you haven't screened it yet?
No, tonight's the premiere.
Wow, amazing. And are you nervous?
I'm not quite sure how I'm feeling, to be honest. When something's this big a deal in your life for this long, it's hard to even know what you're feeling.
Yeah, I can imagine. I bet you at a certain point, having spent a fair bit of time on stage over the years, the adrenaline will kick in soon. Mm-hmm. And do you drink coffee?
Absolutely.
Yes, and large amounts of alcohol. You might want to mix the two, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have early morning screenings, so the alcohol won't be happening. But
no,
definitely lots of coffee.
Oh, Alethea, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. It's okay. My first interview was I was in the car by 6:20 this morning.
Oh, is that right?
Not a morning person, so.
Oh, is that right? Well, at least you sharpened your teeth with that interview, I suppose. Yeah. Well, listen, you know, first of all, congratulations. I wish you all the best tonight. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that whole Hot Docs thing as well. But tell us about the film. I mean, rather than me tell, you know, our listeners about it, I mean, I want to hear it from you, the passionate voice. I mean, first of all, congratulations. It's a remarkable film. And for me, as a guy that's, you know, all about social change and international development and so on, the one of the things that stands out to me so much is that, wow, do we ever misunderstand others more often than not, it seems to me, you know, and that for me, I mean, it's about the anti-seal campaigns, it's about the Inuit, it's about cross-cultural effectiveness, it's about listening, but give us a little bit of that passion, because it sure comes through in the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm Inuit, I'm born and raised in the Arctic, I still live there, and, you know, we're the people of the seal. Inuit are known to be seal hunters, and it's how we survived in one of the harshest environments for millennia. And I think most people know, you know, if they know anything about Inuit, they know that we're seal hunters.
Right.
As a people and seal meat eaters. But for some reason, for lots of reasons, people don't think of us when they talk about commercial sealing. There have been many campaigns over decades fighting against seal hunting, and it kind of boggles my mind that people manage to spend huge amounts of time and money discussing the issue of commercial seal hunting without a thought to the Inuit, who are actually the majority of commercial sealers. So this film's kind of about how we've been affected over the decades on the issue, and how a new generation of Inuit, myself included, are fighting back and fighting to be heard and seen using modern technology and social media.
Well, I think, you know, what one of the things that struck me, too, was how long this has been going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how you point out 1983 was kind of a seminal moment, a real milestone for the campaigners and also, though, for the Inuit themselves.
For animal rights movements in general.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, and so talk about that a little bit, because I don't think many of us know actually the history, really. I mean, we think white seals, you know, we think the little white stuffies,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you so focus on when you head out to the European Union, and you give a really broad it took you 8 years to film this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Almost to the day. In a couple of days, it will be 8 years.
Almost to the day. Wow, that's a huge commitment. And I think that's something for me that really bubbles to the surface throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just your passionate, your intent, your focus, and your desire to set the record straight, as it were.
Yeah, well, you know, it took 8 years, and that's a long time, and it's definitely a big part of my life. But having grown up with the issue and knowing that Inuit have been dealing with this for decades and will continue to deal with this likely for a long time to come. 8 years also kind of feels like a blip.
Right, I bet.
But I tried to capture the issue in a broader way, and I tried not to focus too much on details and specific arguments and cover it in a holistic way, because for us, it's not just about hunting and eating seal and selling seal skins. It's also about protecting our environment,
mm-hmm.
and all the animals in the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
and our whole way of life and our identity as well. It's there are a lot of angles to the story, and I couldn't as an Inuk filmmaker, I couldn't cover the entire Inuit perspective, and it's very much a personal perspective. I don't represent all Inuit, but it's my take on how the world has seen us, or more accurately, probably not seen us.
Have you shared it with many Inuit leaders or communities yet? Have you had feedback?
I've screened it privately, a rough version of it, because it was really only done last week, with the president of the National Inuit Association.
Ooh, you like to run it right up to the last minute, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was still trying to get interviews with the
the
animal groups.
Of course.
At the last minute, so, it, you know, it's really hard to nail down when the film is done when you're still trying to reach out and be heard and have discussions.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was done recently, and I haven't had a chance to screen it with a lot of people yet because it was done so recently. But I screened it with the president of the National Inuit Association, and it was definitely rewarding.
Great.
and a relief to hear that there weren't huge issues for him.
Well, one of the things,
but I also worked closely with a lot of Inuit on the film.
Of course, yeah, and that really comes through. I mean, it's mm-hmm. something. I mean, let's say I went in as a filmmaker to try to do this. There would have been there would have been cross-cultural things. There would have been issues of trust and so on. You didn't have to worry about any of that, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, I have to worry about different things. I have to worry about being seen as a person representing Inuit on the mm-hmm. issue, and I'm mm-hmm. just one filmmaker with one personal
sure.
opinion. But certainly I did my best to be honest about it, to portray people honestly, to let them speak, and to speak with people who are respected and show them for who they are. So, you know, I spoke with, we had the chair of the Hunters and Trappers Association in my community in the film. hunters who have sold sealskin their whole lives. And IU Peter, who is one of the main characters in my film, she's been an advocate on this issue.
Yes.
In an unofficial way. She's not
right,
elected.
Right.
She's not part of any organization. She doesn't have money. She's not paid to do this. But she's been doing it for over 20 years. So, when you're from the community and covering your own people, it can be really hard to separate yourself sometimes from the issue and know whether you're doing things in a balanced way. But at some point, I just had to decide that I'm going to tell my truth and portray this issue the way I see it, and that's the most honest way I can do it.
I think, you know, right from your establishing shot, which is absolutely glorious and gorgeous, and it's but at the same time, you know, has this, for somebody like me, and I come out of a fairly cold environment. I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia where it's very hot.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent time in Mongolia. I remember being on a trip that went into Cambodia and Mongolia in a 3-week period, and I think I spread about an 80 degree difference in temperatures. I went from, you know, 42 Celsius to about minus 38 or something like
mm-hmm.
that. And you see the opening shots and it's beautiful and you kind of want to almost play there. In the north, in this sea of snow.
Yet,
for me, I just went, I went to sort of almost, and maybe this is personal, but I went to the loneliness of that, the separation of that, the, wow, you're kind of on your own out here, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess different people read it different ways, because I see that image and I think fond memories
of course.
My family and
I bet you
children
do.
Playing and
yeah.
food. And
yeah.
So, yeah, it's funny the different perspectives coming from different places. That opening shot, it's a long, slow, beautiful pan of the ocean, the Arctic Ocean and sea ice. And my director of photography, by the way, is an Inuk seal hunter.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was hilarious at times. He'd be really frustrated seeing a seal and having to film it instead of shooting it with a rifle.
Oh, okay. Okay, you just described the premise for a comedy routine. That's hilarious.
He said, I'm not used to shooting seals with a camera.
With a camera, yes.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I'm really proud of the aesthetic in this film.
Yeah.
My director of photography is extremely talented, and I'm just so proud that he's from my home community. And I think you can really feel in the film that it's an inside job.
Really,
you know, when the hunter is butchering the seal, my DOP, Khayar, knew exactly what was going to happen next because he does the same thing, and he just got shots that a southern DOP would never be able to get.
Right, right. So there's almost an intimacy that your director of photography brought to the conversation, if you will.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's quite beautiful. Yeah, no, I saw it as, I guess, reflecting back on the film as I went through my notes, I saw it as what a beautiful way to set up the conversation. You know, the Inuit have been, to some degree, separate and distinct from other aspects of our culture. And yes, we know about them and we understand them to some degree, but wow, have we ever got a long way to go? That's kind of how I saw it, metaphorically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a lot of debate actually with my producers and my editor about the opening shots in the film, and you always want to establish where you are and who's telling the story at the beginning of the film. And I really flip flop between showing the flow edge, the sea ice, because that's the image people know of Inuit, and I want to change minds with this film. I want people to see us as a modern people. And at one point I had the film opening with a birthday party scene, Inuit in the town, indoors, having a birthday party eating seal meat, but dressed up for a birthday party. And it was a tough decision to go back and forth. And in the end, I decided to start with the issue. You know, this is our environment. This is what we're trying to protect. This is where we are. And this is the food we have available to us. So in the end, that's the opening, and I'm glad I stuck with it. But we also, when Inuit are represented in media, we're often shown to be out on the land, and that's it. And I'm really proud that we come home with the hunter. We see him share the meat, and then we go inside his house and hang out with his family, eating and chatting and laughing and cracking jokes. So it also shows us in our daily, you know, the other side of our daily lives.
I hope this doesn't sound the wrong, you don't get the wrong impression from this, Alethea, but I think you've really humanized your culture in a way that I think is desperately needed for.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, for people in the South, if you will, you know, which is so crazy because we're Canadians, but at the same time, you go, wow, like honestly, because I spend so much time in other cultures, mostly Buddhist cultures, I am always struck, and I talk to my students about this all the time. I'm always struck about how poor. We're kind of crummy listeners, us human beings. You know what I mean? We really don't listen to each other very well. We metaphorically or literally sit on the edge of our seat waiting to say what we want to say.
Mm.
And I mean, I think you just referred to it. You know, the reason your film wasn't finished is because you were trying to reach out to be heard, mm-hmm. and you still hadn't heard back from these animal rights groups because they actually maybe don't really want to get involved in the intimate aspects of the conversation. And that just makes me crazy.
Yeah, there's definitely been some hesitation. I mean, a few years went by without a word, without ever a response from any of these groups. Recently, they have started responding to emails and saying that they'd be open to speaking with me on camera.
Mm.
It's too late now.
It's too late for the film.
And I've had some email exchanges with a woman from the International Fund for Animal Welfare. But, you know, scheduling doesn't work out.
Right, of course not.
You know, the typical things.
Yes,
even though we can do interviews by Skype nowadays, there's still a hesitance to,
sure.
to do that. And to be honest, I understand why. It doesn't look good on these groups
mm-hmm.
that they've been contributing to poverty and hunger in some of the poorest and hungriest communities in North America.
Well, the piece that you have from 1978 with Paul Watson,
mm-hmm.
and is it Barbara Frum?
Yes.
I mean, to talk about a damning piece of video evidence. I mean,
I just about fell out of my chair when I saw that.
No kidding. It's troubling on so many levels, right?
And, you know, Paul Watson is his own entity now. Like, he's a personality. He's not just a staff member or an individual animal rights activist anymore. He's a brand. So when I found this clip years ago, it blew me away. But then he's, you know, they started the Whale Wars show on TV, and now he's much more of a celebrity than when I first found it, and it's even more relevant and damning, I think. So I'm really interested to see how people react to that.
Yeah, how that plays out. Well, I think it's really interesting, you know, having spent so many years in this sort of world, this international development world, the fundraising world, et cetera, the nonprofit sector, it is kind of a... I was going to say it's a footnote. It's not a footnote. It's kind of a damning statement almost to the way organizations go about raising money. And mm-hmm. this is one of the sort of the offshoots of a film like this. And this is what I love about filmmaking is the nuance and the subtlety and the layers, because I so hope your film, by the way, gets a wide academic release, universities, schools becomes, you know, necessary viewing actually mm-hmm. for public schools at some level, because for so many reasons, and this is one of them, because you know you could teach a course on just that alone. You know?
Yeah, well, you know, extremism is mm-hmm. rarely a good thing. And I think people who work for animal rights groups or donate to them are sometimes extremist, some of the staff that work there and also the people who donate to them. And they don't want to see the wide-reaching effects that their campaigns have on people who can't afford to lose any more than they've already lost. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they react. I've gotten my bets on some of the first statements that'll come out from some of the groups, because I've seen them over the years, and I've been watching them so closely and kind of analyzing how they... how they respond when Inuit are brought up, and it's usually pretty condescending, like we just don't know any better, we don't realize they're not against Inuit, and we're being used by the Canadian government or by industry to protect the commercial hunt, as they call it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, which completely doesn't acknowledge the fact that Inuit are part of the commercial hunt.
There's
more than one.
I think at the risk of sounding, I mean, I don't know what this means, but there's a Western arrogance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is so weird because we're all sort of living in the Western hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this arrogance to I know this issue better than you would, or you do, mm-hmm. and that's why we can go and we can make these crazy pronouncements, or we can raise funds on one portion of what is going on in this world, and yet totally misunderstand the other. I mean, is it Lhasa Lucy? Is that the man's name?
That's right.
Yeah, and so he's talking about hunting and how important this is to him, and it's a part of his culture, and it's his life, and this is exactly, you know, what he wants to do, and how I think at one moment he talks about how much he loves hunting, you know, and yeah. how this is, I love that moment, mm-hmm. but he talks about it being our food and our clothing, and then he says, but I'd really like to meet one of these activists face to face.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened.
No.
That to me is probably maybe hey, how's that for definition? It's one of the most damning moments in the film.
It's powerful.
It's incredibly powerful, Alethea.
Yeah, because I mean, you see who's being affected, and that he is there, ready to talk to anybody who will talk to him about it, and nobody shows up, nobody talks to him about it, except for a fellow Inuk.
Right.
So the best I can do is try to bring his voice out there, because they're not coming to him. And the, you know, something I wanted to point out with that moment is, you know, the film's called Angry Inuk, which has been a little controversial in my own community, because Inuit tend to, and I cover this in the film, Inuit tend to express anger a little more softly and gently than Western, or as I call it, Southern society does.
You have to tell us a little bit about the song battles as well.
Yeah.
I want you to unpack that for us, because that was wonderful stuff.
This is something I didn't know about until I was an adult, but when I read about it, I thought, that's why. There was a tradition in ancient Inuit culture that's been well documented by the old ethnographers of back then that traveled and came across, made first contact with Inuit. And I don't really know how to describe it in English, except for maybe calling it something like the anger dance. And it was a way to resolve conflict. So people lived in tiny family camps, were semi-nomadic, so you might spend spring and summer in one area and winter in another. And they traveled in small groups of families. And so, you know, when you're in a tiny group, even in a family relationship, you can let someone know you're pissed off with a look.
right.
You don't have to scream and yell. You can, you know, just a raised eyebrow or an expression on your face. You can communicate so much with very little. Mm-hmm. And I think with that in mind, Inuit living in family camps, we didn't have to express anger so loudly. So we have a lower bar for communicating anger. And displeasure. Also, living in such a harsh environment, survival being so hard, the communities had to work together to survive.
Sure.
So maintaining harmony was absolutely crucial to survival. So we tend to, even today, avoid direct confrontation. But back then, the way they would resolve confrontation is if someone had pissed me off, for example.
Yep.
You'd go to the dance house, you know, whether it's the big igloo or the hugbiq, we call it. They'd make a larger igloo in the winter, and people would go in and do drum dancing and singing, and sing about their daily hunt and, you know, stories from their family and that kind of thing. But if someone had pissed you off, you could go to the hugbiq and do a satiric song and make fun of the person that pissed you off.
Right.
And then, using humor to kind of diffuse the tension. And then when you're done, they jump up and do their response. And so they'd use humor and go back and forth and tease each other until humor diffused the tension, or until someone lost their temper. But if you lose your temper, you lose the battle.
Right.
Because, you know, it's kind of human nature to get defensive when you've done something wrong. I think a lot of people, if they've done something wrong and they don't want to be called on it, and someone calls you on it, people can get defensive and react, you know, like the old "methinks he doth protest too much" or whatever.
Right.
So with that in mind, Inuit still today kind of avoid confrontation. We often use humor to let people know that something's not cool.
You know, I was interviewing a Buddhist lama recently. Mm-hmm. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, a guy I've spent years in Tibet studying under the Dalai Lama and so on, and he talked about something in Tibetan Buddhism called humorful humility.
Mm.
And that's kind of, it's just interesting timing for me that I spoke to him about this notion. And seeing that, there's a certain humility in being able to, first of all, being able to say to somebody that you are, in fact, angry with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way they react, like, I think the comment in the film is something about there's almost an imposition of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
If you get angry, if you lose your temper.
Exactly.
Right? It's almost like you're showing your cards, right? in a sense.
Exactly. And also, we have this principle of not going overboard.
Right.
You know, if you become extreme on something, you're right, there's some kind of admission of guilt in that. And something people will often say, whether you're too excited or too angry or too anything, they'll say, like, don't do too much or don't have too much. Or it's
right.
Just moderation is a big thing for us. So even though we've been so devastated as a people by the anti-seal hunt campaigns, Inuit still don't want to appear
sure.
angry
sure.
And appear like we're going overboard on it.
Which is so interesting to me, Alethea, in a mm-hmm. sense, you know, the irony of that, you know, the moderation, the measured reaction mm-hmm. to not only to one another and to those in the community, but to those who are actually criticizing us and who are, it seems, incredibly gifted in extremes. And I mean, you even talk about how the anti-sealing campaign has painted pretty much everyone as being evil mm-hmm. If they're involved in anything along these lines.
They literally draw devil horns on seals.
I couldn't believe that. The one in the elevator, the scene with the devil's horns, I was stunned.
Yeah. So it's a tough line for me to walk mm-hmm. Making this film, because I want to stay true to Inuit culture. I want to present us as who we are. But I'm bicultural. I've grown up with a foot in both worlds. I did
right.
my education in the south of Canada. And I think the important thing with this film is to make the world understand our style of anger so that they can see that we need to be taken seriously. Just because we're not screaming and yelling and throwing bombs doesn't mean that this isn't extremely distressing for us.
So just before we talk about the youth's involvement in SEAL fees and all of that, which mm-hmm. is really, there's some really moving stuff that you sort of share there and just the whole the anti-protest mm-hmm. almost, I guess you could say. Tell me a little bit more about the 83 ban, and I'm hoping all our listeners are going to get to see this film, but tell me a little bit more about that, and more importantly, the implications. And I think that's something else. You know, everything we do affects something or someone else, it seems to me. There's this causality to the decisions we make at a high level, top down, but also bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about some of those implications? I mean, you talk about 25 years to rebuild after the mm-hmm. 83 ban.
That's
and
right.
probably still working through some of those nuances today, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, there was a reason that these anti-seal hunt campaigns begun. And I think a lot of pro-sealers might not want to admit this or talk about it or even know about it. But in my research, I came across graphs showing the population of seals in the Atlantic Canada. And there was a point a long, long, long time ago where the population of harp seals did drop. They're not endangered. They have never been. Their population is massive right now. But there was a point where commercial sealing in the south of Canada was done mainly by Canadians. But there was a point where, ironically, it was the European seal hunters that came over to Canada and used much larger boats and started hunting them in much larger numbers. So it's totally ironic that the Europeans became so, you know, moral about the whole thing when the population started dwindling. So there was a point where the harp seal population was dropping, and it was a good thing. I think it was a good thing that people spoke up to protect the population. And so the government put quotas in place
right.
to protect, the conservation issue at
sure,
the time.
Sure, sure. Yep.
So they put in quotas, but then that meant that the sealers that went out there suddenly had to fight for their share of the quota.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this was like a 1 or 2 year period where things went a little berserk for a while. They were hunting them too quickly to try to get their share of the quota, and there were animal welfare concerns for a very short period of time. The government responded very quickly, thanks to the seal hunt campaigners that drew attention to the issue. So, you know, it might sound strange, but I actually appreciate that they did that at that point in time.
Right.
So they put in limits on how many seals could be caught by a particular boat per day, and put in regulations on how the seals are killed so that they're not suffering. But that was addressed very quickly. Unfortunately, in that very short period of time, a handful of people saw how much money they were able to raise so quickly to fight on this issue. So instead of being about conservation, it became about, oh, aren't these animals cute?
Mm.
And this brings in a lot of money for other animal welfare issues. So the campaigns kind of stuck around. And they kept fighting, despite the fact that it became illegal 35 years ago to hunt white-coat baby harp seals. They'll still use these images of white coats in their campaigns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the European Union, in 1983, banned the sale of products made from white-coat harp seals. And they put in an exemption for Inuit, which is interesting because in Canada, the harp seal, they give birth in the south of Canada, and the harp seals migrate north only during the summer. So by the time they reach Inuit lands, they're adults. Mm. So, you know, it was kind of pointless to put in an exemption for Inuit because we don't hunt white coats anyway.
Wow, okay.
But despite the exemption for Inuit, despite the ban only being about white coats, the prices for all seal skins around the world from anywhere, no matter who hunted them, completely crashed. And it, as I say in the film, it was our Great Depression. People went hungry. Hunters' income went from tens of thousands of dollars a year down to less than $1,000 a year in some communities. And, I mean, I have friends who vividly remember taking the seal skins that their grandfather or father hunted and that their mother scraped and cleaned, and going door to door as children, begging
right.
any white person in the community to see if they would want to buy it, and the humiliation they faced and the hunger they faced. My friends and family were affected by this, and it's really hard to see that and know about it and watch people just ignore it.
Well, it's such a classic and tragic statement about not getting involved before you really understand an issue. I mean, it's about intention. It's about it's about unpacking it. It's about listening. It's about those activists who didn't come in to the community to visit with you know Lhasa Luzi and others,
yeah.
right? I mean, had they really understood what was going on, you would like to think. I mean, maybe they wouldn't, but you'd like to think the approach would have been different.
Yeah, well, and for me, what really shocked me the more I looked into this was it wasn't by accident. You know, I can forgive mistakes. I can, you know, nobody's perfect. Maybe intentions were good in the beginning, and, you know, if people didn't realize the effect they were having on Inuit, that would be one thing. But very, very quickly, Inuit leaders were telling these groups what they were going through. And that people were going hungry, and that people were losing hope at being able to do anything with their life and feed their children. And so these groups, their board members, their staff, they were all keenly aware of how they're affecting Inuit and just continued to do what they
continued
were doing.
Continued to do it anyway.
And made no effort at putting any nuance into their campaigns. They still, to this day, after decades of Inuit telling them to stop referring to southern Canadian seal hunts as the seal hunt,
right,
or the commercial seal hunt, because there are actually two, even within southern Canada. It's the Magdalen Islands in Quebec and around Newfoundland and the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and they're very close by, but they're two distinct groups of people that are ceiling in southern Canada commercially, and not to mention the Inuit in Labrador. But there's also commercial sealing in northern Canada as well as Greenland, and you know many countries around the world that hunt seals. But of course, most sealing happens in Canada and Greenland. So you know they were told immediately what effect they were having mm-hmm. on Inuit, and there is no attempt to change their language. They still talk about it as if seal hunting is inherently inhumane. They still call it the seal hunt. Without
making the distinctions.
No distinction whatsoever.
Well, one of the things that really was interesting for me and kind of a shock in a way was this idea of, oh, well, but, you know, subsistence hunting is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't allow for the whole idea behind sustainable livelihoods, right? And this notion that, hang on a minute here, these are far-reaching implications
mm-hmm.
if we shut this down.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think people are, when they say they're okay with subsistence hunting, I think the intention's good and protect
sure.
wildlife and,
sure.
and not affect Inuit by saying that. But really, to me, it's kind of a condescending statement to make because, you know, why do I have to be stuck in the past? Why do I have to live 200 years ago without money? And, you know, I've got to pay rent.
Right.
I have a cell
right.
phone bill to pay.
Right.
Why do people expect Inuit to live like we did 200 years ago while the rest of the world modernizes and lives on a cash economy?
Right, right.
We don't have a choice for a lot of reasons. You know, the Canadian government did their damnedest to make us look, walk, and talk like Southern Canadians. And although...
Yeah, it didn't play out too well, did it?
No, it didn't play out too well, but it had its long-lasting effects
mm-hmm.
and... irreversible effect. Inuit are not going to all move back out onto the land full time. That's just not going to happen anymore.
Well, and I think, you know, just to come back kind of full circle, I mean, I think you made the right choice about your establishing shot
mm-hmm.
in the film,
mm-hmm.
you know, just giving that sense of we're all in this together, and yet we are kind of very much distinct
mm-hmm.
in who we are and where we are.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's not, this isn't just about a tradition. And a stubbornness on the Inuit's part,
mm-hmm.
or at least I didn't get that sense.
Yeah.
This is way more subtle and nuanced than that.
Yeah, I very deliberately avoided repeating the traditional, this is tradition and culture for us.
Right.
Because it's not just that, we're modern. This is not about ancient tradition for me. It is about modern survival. And the most ethical and sustainable way for us to make a living today is to live from the resources, the renewable resources that we have.
Mm.
And we as a people are desperately trying to figure out how we can employ more of our people and lift ourselves out of poverty without destroying our environment. And that's a really difficult thing to do
yeah.
that we've been trying to figure out for a long time, ever since the 83 ban happened and we lost that
right.
Source of income. Believe me, we've been trying to figure it out. You know, I get a lot of tweets from people saying, why don't you just do greenhouses and,
right.
you know, find
right.
other ways, other things to manufacture. And it's just not that easy when you live thousands of kilometers away from everyone else in a really harsh environment with no trees, no agriculture, no nothing. The choices are pretty much
pretty limited.
Drill into the ground or the ocean for oil and diamonds and all that, or sell sealskin.
Yeah.
And sealskin's looking pretty attractive to me.
So we're going to have to wrap up in a couple of minutes here. Tell me about what you are encouraged by, what you are, the young people in the film, the shots on the bus, the seal fees,
mm-hmm.
the campaign. Yes, it had some negative implications without a doubt, which are completely, astounding to me,
mm-hmm.
Which maybe we'll leave for our listeners to find out about. But were you encouraged by that? That youthful energy that said, hey, we want to be a part of this as well. We want to change the conversation. We want to help to change the conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, something that I didn't have time to cover in the film, there's a group of students that travel to Europe and lobby on this issue. It's a political science program based out of Ottawa called Nunavut Sivuniksevut. And so Inuit students from all over Nunavut and now actually Labrador in the Northwest Territories as well go and study in Ottawa. They study Inuit history and recent political history and the land claims agreements. And each year they fundraise all year round from Inuit businesses and communities to take their whole class on a trip somewhere. And they usually go somewhere hot.
Right, right.
And what they usually do is they visit another Indigenous people in another country. And it's a really fun learning experience
for
them.
Sure, sure.
And that year that I traveled with them and filmed with them, I was blown away because they decided to forego their fun trip to a hot country because they felt it was just too important moment in our society. So they decided to go to the European Union and lobby the EU parliamentarians there to change their minds about the new ban they were putting in place, because it's not just the 83 ban. In 2009, they put another ban that was even more strict into place. And these students felt it was so important. I was so impressed. I mean, these youth are like 17, 18, 19 years old.
Yeah, amazing.
And they could have just had a fun trip anywhere in the world they wanted to go, and they decided this is important, and they went. And that just... It was so amazing to me, and I was so proud to see them speak so eloquently and in such an Inuk way.
Nice.
The young woman who ends the speech by saying, we've got to end the cultural prejudice, and we need to be able to benefit from our natural surroundings without having to drill into the ground. And that's really all we want as a people.
It's
such a great moment. She's so
wonderful.
Sweet.
Yes.
With a smile and just... how can you argue with that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Are you hopeful? I mean, near the end of the film, you talk a little bit about a Greenpeace apology, about, you mentioned earlier that, some folks are starting to get back to you now. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a part two here.
I hope so. I hope the situation changes so much that it requires a new film. Greenpeace, I think the fact that the animal groups were so hesitant to talk to me, it was really frustrating, but it also made me hopeful in a weird way, because the fact that they were so afraid to talk to an Inuk publicly.
I know, it's...
It shows me that they know it doesn't look good on them to be harming Inuit. That shows me that the world does care about Indigenous people.
Right, right.
The world cares about us being able to live and survive and feed ourselves and thrive. And the fact that they don't want to appear like they're hurting us makes me think there's hope. If we just let people know what's happening to us,
it's good.
There's hope of turning this around. And I think there's a new generation that's coming up through these organizations that recognizes that it's time for a new model of animal activism. One
good.
That makes room for nuance,
it's
one
good.
That is more holistic, that's not so extremist, and that recognizes that the hunters that are out there hunting seals, they're the ones that are standing their ground against the huge mining companies and the corporations that are trying to destroy the Arctic and drill for oil.
It's a bit of a paradox there, isn't there?
Those hunters are the key to protecting the whole environment. And I think there's a new generation coming through that's ready to see that.
So just can I tell you one of my? I had lots of favorite moments in the film, the moment where the skins are to be cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids take them out and use them as toboggans.
Which is actually functional. They're cleaning the oil residue out the skins, and it's a lot of fun.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. So tonight, May 2nd, 7 p.m., is the, I guess, could you say world premiere?
It is the world premiere.
Wow, at Hot Docs. Congratulations, again, for a remarkable, fascinating film. I learned a heck of a lot, and I'm hopeful with you, Alethea. I mean, I think a long way to go, without a doubt, but it's filmmakers like you that are getting this out there, that are challenging the status quo, that are asking deeper questions, for crying out loud. It's about time.
Thank you so much.
So, thanks for joining us today. The film is Angry Inuk, and if you can't get there tonight, it's playing on the 4th and again on the 7th. Hot Docs. I'm hoping it's going to get a wide release. Alethea Arnakook-Baril with us here today. Thanks again, Alethea.
Thanks so much for having me.